So we are live today with Jim Butcher. I think probably everybody who's going to be watching this knows who he is. I am going to use your very short bio that you have because it's very succinct and I liked it. A martial arts enthusiast whose resume includes a long list of skills rendered obsolete at least 200 years ago. I know it's been your bio forever, but I still love it. New York Times bestselling author Jim Butcher turned to writing as a career because anything else probably would have driven him insane. He lives mostly inside his own head so that he can write down the conversation of his imaginary friends, but his head can generally be found in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. Jim is the author of The Dresden Files, which I love, the Codex Alera novels, which I apologize in the last email I sent you, I referred to them as the Furies, but Furies in every title, and that's what was stuck in my head. And of course, my son absolutely loved that series, by the way. And the Cinder Spire series, which has been a long time coming, which is one of my daughter's favorites. So just to run out there. So yeah, you've got like three different main series going on, and everybody in my family is a huge fan of at least one of them. I did have to poke a little fun at you because I don't know for how long, but this is the picture that we are used to seeing at the back of all of your novels. Yeah. And then when they sent me the arc of the new one, I got that picture and I'm like, who's that guy? It looks good. I'm just so used to the long haired Jim Butcher. It threw me off for a second. I had to double check to make sure that was you. And I'm like, yes, it is. So I've already kind of alluded to the first one. I kind of jokingly asked you when you decided to cut the locks, but you know, that wasn't a particularly serious question. Now you do have, as I mentioned, three different fantasy novels. I would call them all fantasy. Jim Butcher, the Dresden Files, obviously is very, what I consider more of an urban fantasy, takes place in the real world. Codex Alera, I think, was much more of just like, I don't know if I want to say regular fantasy, but it's just a straight fantasy. It's not set here in the U.S., or excuse me, in the real world. But then, even though, as I jokingly referred to you, there's no actual steam engines, to me, Cinder Spires is very much a steampunk type fantasy.
Well, there's steam engines. We just haven't run into them very often.
Did you, are those happenstance that you kind of put those separate, or just the way the stories ended up in your head? One you wanted in the real world, one is this very steampunk, and one's regular fantasy. Was it just happenstance, or did you like the idea of being able to switch between those worlds back and forth?
Oh, well, when I set out to become a writer, I was going to be a swords and horses Tolkien-esque fantasy writer. That's what I was going to do. And I wound up not doing that as a way to prove a point to my writing teacher. And that was how the Dresden Files got started, was as a class project that just got completely out of hand.
We appreciate it, though. I do like the Dresden Files.
That's good, yeah. Yeah, well, for me as well, you know, but it's a little humbling to have to keep recounting my origin story of, you know, how I got there,
so. Gotcha. We won't go too deep into that. Mainly, we want to get to the books. I did have a few questions before we get into Olympian Affair. Dresden Files, I did have one question for you, and I know, I'm sorry, I'm going to take you back to the show.
Okay.
Did they get rid of the Volkswagen just because, you know, Paul Blackthorne couldn't fold himself up into it?
No, that had more to do with the fact that if you shoot in a Volkswagen, you can only shoot from two angles, which is directly ahead or directly perpendicular next to it. Wanted to do any kind of extensive shooting, you had to do what Disney did and have a trick Volkswagen that came apart into bits, so that depending on how close the camera was going to be, you could keep the actors inside it. They said, you know what, we're going to stick with the same theme and idea, because a Korean era World War II is, you know, you can make them run on kerosene, and you can fix them with some baling wire and some duct tape, you know, whatever's wrong with them. And so that would be the perfect vehicle for a wizard. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. That would work. You know, and so that part, I had no trouble with that at all, because they stuck to the story.
Which was nice.
Yeah, which was the good part. Yeah.
I'm going to throw this out here. I actually really liked that show. I thought Paul Blackthorne especially was good as the lead. I think the only thing that I think it suffered from, and this was not on you, part of the reason that it didn't last as long, is I think it suffered kind of like, if you remember Smallville, season two, the network decided we want a villain of the week. You know, we want a monster of the week. And I think that's the only thing that came back. It was very much Dresden Files, but it was also very episodic. I think your books tie together. There's a long, long range story that goes through the Dresden Files that they didn't do in the show.
Yeah, that show was originally supposed to be a serial of the first two books in the series, and then they were going to have a big old climax with both the villains from the first two books to be the climax at the end of season one. And that was the original plan. And then 2 weeks before they started shooting, they put somebody different in charge of the show that said, nah, we don't want to do serial because nobody likes those. We want to do episodic because that's what everybody likes. They're like, well, we don't have time to rewrite it. And they're like, just change the episode, the order of all the episodes and change all the characters' names and cast a bunch of new people at the last moment. It'll be fine.
Yeah, leave it to Hollywood to mess it up. I did specifically like Paul Blackthorne in that role.
Yeah, I had no trouble with any of the folks who were actually in the trenches working on that show. They did a really good job, but there were issues.
Before we get into the actual book itself, what does a day in the life of Jim Butcher look like? Like, when do you do your writing? How do you schedule your day?
Well, I get up at 6:30. I take my stepson to school. I work out. I come home. I sit down and do some writing. Usually there's some stuff to do around the house and I need to have some lunch. And, you know, often there are errands or something like that or interviews. So I'll do that then. And then I'll try and sit down for a bit more writing. And then I try and write a bit more before I go to sleep. And I find that I get the most done if I just have about three different points in the day where I tell myself, okay, you need to sit down and try and get something done. I don't pressure myself too hard to get anything done at any single one of those times, you know? So, you know, if I finish off 200 words, it's like, okay, that's a good effort. And, you know, if I'm just not concentrating right now, that's fine. Maybe the chapter isn't done as yet. But I usually find that at least one of those time periods, I'll take off and wind up with, you know, 1500 words or something like that. It'll work out fine. Yeah, most days, you know, weekends, I usually only write maybe when I go to bed.
And I love that answer for the fact that I've done a few of these before. And I feel like a lot of times people ask these type of questions looking like, okay, I want to be a writer. What do I want to do? And every author's got different times. There are some that's like, no, I write as soon as I get out of bed before anybody else is up. I got to have that time to myself. Other ones, you know, it's like right before bed, my mind's relaxed, you know, let stuff go to paper before I fall asleep. And you've got three a day. So, you know, you've got the full workout going. So basically to the people who are aspiring to be writers, I think the answer is whatever works for you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's at the end of the day, the only thing that's important is that you are there making the words come out. If you can make the words come out, that's the right way to do it.
I feel like you've almost answered your next question. It sounds like you probably, the way you said it, you come home and write. You've got like an office or something there in the office. That's kind of your, this is my space.
Well, when I'm at my best, I'm working in the office, but oftentimes I'm just spread out all over the house. You know, it's like I'll just grab my laptop and go wherever's comfortable. You know, this room is too cold on some days, and so I'll go over to a room that's not quite as cool. And you know, other places in the house are too warm, and so I can't go right there. You know, when it's during the summer.
Oh, I get that. Yeah, I've been here because I've got the big window, which is my best lighting. But that also means I've got the this time of year, I've got the little space heater next to me. It's like it gets cold in here.
Oh, yeah. All right.
So obviously Dresden Files, Codex Alera, they came out at a little bit more of an accelerated pace than we've seen with the Cinder Spires.
Yes.
And I was going to ask you, as long as it took, was it the nature? And I think I actually read a little bit about this after I sent you the question, but I still don't know if everybody knows. Was it just the nature of this much more epic fantasy covering so many different characters? Or is it just the fact that life happened and that's why Olympian Affair has taken so long to get book two than your other series have?
Oh, life happened. I was actually at the point of where I was thinking maybe I should set the steampunk aside and give, you know, one of my fantasy ideas a whirl right here. And I went to Dragon Con last year and all these people, I had 20 or 25 different fans come up to me and say, hey, I'm really looking forward to the next Cinder Spires book. And then I was like, oh my gosh, there's people that love it. I need to keep going at least for a while longer. So I had my idea for the second book kind of crystallized at that point, and I put it all together and it came together real well. I think it's one of the better things I've written. And I'm looking forward to writing the next one. I mean, I got to end it at a really good point to set up the next book for a lot of fun. So I love it when it kind of writes itself, you know, that's what it feels like.
Yeah. Well, two things off of that. One, you've made my daughter very happy because she absolutely loved Aeronauts Windlass. Two, can't remember what two was. Oh, two was the acknowledgement at the back. I kind of answered another question I was going to have. You just mentioned it as again, so we'll just kind of skip that question. There are more books to be coming in this series. I was originally going to ask you if two was going to wrap it up, but then I read the afterword or the acknowledgement or whatever at the back of the ARC. By the way, guys, that book drops today, so you don't get to be jealous of my arc anymore. You can go buy it yourself. And then three, I'm just going to sneak this one in here. I talked to you very, very briefly before we went online. There's a scene at the end of that book. The tears did not fall, but they did well up, you bastard. I'm just letting you know that was very good, very emotional scene. And that's all I'm going to say about it, because you've got so many characters. I don't even want to give anybody a hint of who's involved or what happens, but have your tissues ready. I almost cried. They were there. I could feel them. All right. But yeah, absolutely. You said that there are people that love this book. Yes, there are people who love this book. And I have to say, I think The Olympia Affair is even better than Aeronauts Windlass was.
Thank you very much.
So yeah, it's it has an audience. It does have an audience. You did drop the Warrior Born novella. And I feel like you might have also just kind of answered this question. I was originally going to ask you why that didn't kind of come out somewhere in between the two books as a bit of a teaser, if you will. But I feel like you also decided to finish up book two relatively recently.
Book two was all last year. And when it was done, I wrote Warrior Born as kind of a lead up to it. I sort of wanted to spark some more interest because it had been a while since the first book and sort of remind people, hey, the story exists. Mm-hmm. And I went out and did Warrior Born as kind of my little James Bond opening segment mission. See some things happening in this world, and we get some action to sort of get everybody introduced to the story that's about to happen. And that's what I was looking for doing that one. And plus I needed to make some money.
Well, money does help. Yes. I will tell anybody who's watching this or watch this later, it's going to be posted on YouTube eventually. If you did not pick up Warrior Born, but you picked up The Olympian Affair, I would say at a minimum, after like maybe chapter one or two, you're probably going to want to go pick up Warrior Born. Warrior Born happens right before The Olympian Affair. And I don't say that it necessarily can't stand on its own, but it answers so many questions of where you are dropping in on The Olympian Affair. I think you almost have to read it in order. It's 146 quick pages. It'll be done in a day. That's all I'm telling you. It was very, very good. Speaking of Warrior Born, I apologize right now if I missed it, but I don't think in the books so far that you have necessarily, and tell me if I'm wrong, explained where the Warrior Born have come from, like what their background is. Is that something, if you haven't said, that you're keeping for a future reveal, or are you enjoying the fact that it's a little bit mysterious why they are the way they are?
Well, what I will say is that about 1.5% of the population tend to be Warrior Born. It's a recessive gene that only occasionally surfaces inside the human population, and that as a result, they tend to be they're kind of a permanent minority, and they're also dangerous, and they also have certain biological factors that are weighing against them in terms of blending in with humanity. Generally speaking, anytime you've got somebody who's who's easily separated from the crowd, there's issues to be dealt with, and the Warrior Born have that, and you'll find out more about them as the story goes on.
Good. No. Also, especially in book one, they all seem to have been referred to as kind of feline. But however, I feel like, unless I'm missing something with Sark, I feel like that Warrior Born gene may not be just feline based. Is that correct?
Oh, well, yeah. Their understanding of things is fairly limited. The society here does not really have a solid grasp on genetics. For them, it's all lineage.
Yeah, Sark seemed to definitely be leaning a different direction. Keeping it to Cinder Spires, who is your favorite character to write?
Oh, it's probably one of the cats.
My daughter will love that.
Great, right? Because the cats just get to say what regular humans never would say out loud. Cats just say it; they don't care. That said, I really enjoyed writing Abigail in this book. She kind of just came up all of a sudden while I was writing. Like, I hadn't planned on having her as a viewpoint character, and I just opened up a chapter and started writing her. And I said, oh, okay, well, I guess you're being very insistent. So apparently I asked, and so I did.
And I will have to say, as much as I loved Raoul in the first book, I think Fenley has proved to be the perfect foil for Raoul.
Yes. Well, Raoul needed somebody to take a little bit of the wind out of him. My favorite scenes are the ones where you know the cats make clear that you just it's like we can fight with each other, but come on, human, the cats are definitely going to gang up on you. So
yeah, I also like the scene, and again, I won't go into details because again, I don't do spoilers. But you've got a scene where Raoul, oh, and I just blanked on her name. The other lead cat went off, and Fenley's just talking to Bridget. That scene was hilarious. I love that.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yes, that was so good.
When Chief Saza walks away, you know, so that
Saza, yes, thank you. Yes, I knew it began with an S and I was stuck. I did have one question about the cats. The cats, obviously, the tribes have very obvious names. Was there anything, did you just name them or was there something specific about Nine Claws? Because the Nine Claws, that's a very, you know, odd number, no pun intended, of claws for a cat. Hmm? Is there a background to that, why you picked Nine Claws?
Well, there's cat history for it, but they're not going to talk to humans about it.
Okay, fine. That's a very good cat answer, by the way. I like that.
Yeah.
You're allowed to keep your, you know, some of it's mysterious. You got to have your secrets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just like, yes, that's our name. We're not going to explain it to you. The littler cats, though, they tend to have the more ferocious names. You know, when you're a powerful tribe, you can have a name that isn't quite so over the top. You know, you don't have to name yourself the demon destroyer dragons, you know. Mm-hmm. When you've got that, but the little cats occasionally they need a bigger name to properly frame how dangerous they are.
Yeah, that's also another thing that I enjoyed between Fenley and Raoul. It's like, you know, somebody who's, you know, did all that wouldn't need to bring it up so often. So I gotta love Fenley. Fenley made me my new favorite. I won't get into the duels other than the fact that A, your duels in that have happened, you know, are epic. I love the fight scenes and stuff that you've had. How much did you have to do for research for that to get a believable, for instance, sword versus sword duel? You know, so I know you've got the martial arts background, but, you know, that's not an everyday occurrence these days.
It's true. The last duel in France is actually on camera. You can watch it on YouTube. So if you want to see what an actual duel looks like, I mean, they just black and white, but you know, you can see it. A lot of the research had to do with talking with very serious martial artists, with reading books about dueling and about which generally amounted to being mostly about the psychology of dueling. Mm-hmm. More than anything. I mean, the mechanics, everybody was pretty clear on, but having the right attitude for a duel was the important thing. A lot of the people that I knew who are into Western martial arts, you know, they would learn all this stuff and they'd be looking at illustrations and books and saying, I don't understand this illustration. I don't understand why, you know, why the dueling stance is like this, you know, with one hand out, until they actually said, okay, well, you know what, let's try a live duel and we'll hurt each other, but let's try it with live steel and see what happens. And when the live steel came out, it changed everything. And suddenly they were leaning way further back to keep their eyes out of range of being poked. And they had one hand up because it was much easier to, you know, to take a shot to the hand than it would be to take one to the eye. And, you know, and the awareness of the mortal danger changed absolutely everything about the duel, that's one of those psychological factors that does that. You know, when fear comes, everything changes, you know, shifts everything. And so I had to write these duels where these characters had to deal with fear. And one of the strategies of dealing with fear was arrogance. You know, was you kind of held up your arrogance as a shield. You know, I put all this practice in. I am so awesome. I'm going to humiliate this person. This duel is only going to go one way. And then the fear doesn't get in the way of your classroom technique. So for some people, that's the way it was. And for other people, the way to overcome fear is just practice, 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 practice until the reflexes are there and you know they're there and you can trust them. And I also did some research on historical duels. And, you know, in particular, Grimm's duel is based on a historical duel between an Italian rapier fighter and a Japanese samurai, where an Italian rapier fighter had killed 30 or 40 samurai in duels. The country of Japan was taking the hit to its honor, you know, by the fact that this guy was existing and doing that. And they actually, apparently this poor samurai came in and said, I know I can kill this man. And they said, well, if you do, you know, we'll make you wealthy. And he did it. He did it exactly the same way my character does in the book. You know, again, when you get into duels were something that was not quite a fight to the death. It could still be lethal, but there was a set of rules and expectations. And at the end of the day, you know, when you draw swords and when people start bleeding, somebody's gonna get killed. And you have to have that set of expectations versus the social strictures that were in place in that time that were trying to limit the violence. So I found that very fascinating to look at and study when I was doing my research. But I could go on about that for a long time. That's one of the things as a writer, you find yourself, buying all these books and scrolling through videos on YouTube and being like, oh yeah, I need to know more about this. Yeah, I do need to know about how do you make sulfuric acid and get rid of a body? Okay, I'm pretty sure anybody in Homeland Security would be horrified if they looked at my browsing history, but like, this is my business. It's what I do. I have to deal with these ideas.
Yeah, I don't think you can be an author without ending up on somebody's watch list somewhere.
Oh, absolutely.
I can't even imagine the poor murder mystery writers. Although to be fair, I mean, to a certain extent, Dresden Files is kind of that whole mystery murder detective series too, even though it does have the fantasy background.
I actually had the Chicago SWAT commander came up to me and said, hey, I need to talk to you about this scene that you set up with a hostage situation on this roof. I just want to know, who did you talk to set that up? Because whoever did, they kind of know what they're doing. And we like to keep track of people like that. I had to look at it and tell them I used Google Earth and my knowledge of Call of Duty. And the SWAT commander looked at me and he just goes, oh, I hate the internet.
Fair. That's exactly. Sometimes my wife and I kind of joke that a lot of these murder mystery TV shows are almost like, how-tos for some people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. These days. Yeah. Yeah. They've gotten more and more specific.
Obviously, we know Cinder Spires, because like I said, it was in the acknowledgement at the back, is going to continue. Do you have any idea how many more books you foresee in the series and when we might expect one?
I think 6 would be good.
Okay.
And I'm working on the next Dresden. I think I'll have it finished by the end of the year. And then with the new year, I can start on the next Cinder Spires book and hopefully finish that one by the end of next summer and go back to my 2 books a year schedule. That's what I would prefer to do.
Gotcha.
We'll see how that works out, because as you go further in your career as a writer, you increasingly have more responsibilities on the job that aren't actually writing. There's more interviews, there's more tours, there's more appearances to be made. There's more people saying, hey, can you support our charitable goal here of whatever we're doing. I like supporting animal charities. I get by a lot of those. And that gets in the way of the writing as compared to the guy who was in his early 30s and just had a couple of books done and was just getting started. And really had nothing to do once he got the kid off to school, had nothing to do all day, but putter around on the book and get the next book done, and absolutely needed to do it in order to get the bills paid.
So you kind of answered another question I had, and I already kind of knew the answer to this one, but I was going to ask it anyhow. But the fact that you said Cinder Spires, you're kind of looking for that 6 book series. I'm guessing we're not planning, doesn't mean it won't happen, but we're not planning on revisiting Codex Alera anytime soon.
I haven't signed any contracts about it or anything. I could go back there and it would be fun, but I've got so many other ideas for so many different kinds of stories I want to tell that, we'll see. I want to do my science fiction books, which are sort of Men in Black meets X-Men on the moon, kind of about 200 years into Earth's future when we are, expanding out to the system. And when we start running into the aliens, and we're on the receiving end of the Prime Directive. And so, when contact is outlawed, only the outlaws make contact. So we have to have somebody who can deal with them. And so that's why the book is called the U.S. Marshals. And it's in this case, the United System Marshals. That's that series. And I really want to do that one because I went back and read through this manuscript that I wrote when I was, 32 or 33 and 20 years ago now. So I go back and look at that. And I was reading this manuscript. And I go, oh, this is really great. Why didn't I keep going with this? But I want to go back and do that. I've got my Fantasy Incredible series I want to write because I think that'll be a ton of fun. And I've got several other ideas. I'm going to have to live to be like 124 to write all these ideas. But it might be possible. We'll see. Mm. What with science and all.
Trust me, my TBR list is probably going to outlive me as well. So I get that. Just letting you know that if you ever do think about Codex Alera, I know a few people who would love to see another book in that series.
If I go back to that one, I'm going to be writing about the first class of the new cursors that come in after Octavian's taken over as emperor. So it'll be like all these new kids and the first Morat cursor and the first Canem cursor. And then, you know, Aaron will be kind of their teacher, and Fidelius will be pottering around in the background, you know, sort of being the old Batman, you know, in the background. So
I would definitely pick it up. I know for a fact my son would pick it up or steal mine, one or the other. I was joking. That's why I couldn't show off Warrior Born. My daughter's already stolen it. So it's like,
there you go.
I read it and then it was gone. I do have to say one other thing. And again, I'm going to avoid spoilers at all cost. We did talk about the duel. You and I, having read the book, you wrote the book, I read the book, know that there is definitely a, can't think of the word I'm looking at, something's going to come from the actions in that duel and how it played out. Kind of see that between two of your main characters at the end. I am totally looking forward to see how that plays out in your next book. So that was a very interesting twist. I did catch, and I think most people will, and I think you did that intentionally, but I did catch the etherealist's slip of the tongue that she doesn't realize until later. I loved that. You knew it. You just were wondering when it was going, the reveal was going to happen. So definitely looking forward to what happens between those two. Yeah. You've left yourself a lot. There's a lot of interesting pairs by the end of the second book.
I get to do a bunch of frenemies stuff next book. And that's some of my favorite stuff to write.
Oh, heck, if you got frenemies going on, heck, Raoul and Fenley will fit in for a frenemies. Oh, yeah. I love the fact that they look at each other questioningly whenever they agree on something. It's right. like, wait a second, maybe this isn't what I want to think. All right, so this one might be kind of short. I'm not getting a whole lot of questions. I do have a few wrap-ups, and if somebody throws something in the chat, I'll come back to it. But I do have questions that I ask every author. What, if any, question, and again, try to remember that I try to avoid spoilers at all costs. I don't even like movie trailers because sometimes it gives something away. What question might you have expected to have been asked that did not come up?
But I don't ever expect questions, so that question is actually harder than you would think.
No, that's fine.
I mean, the usual questions are, I mean, it depends on mm-hmm. the source of. All right, so I'm talking to you, and you are in the nerd sphere, so I'm going to get questions from you, and I would expect to get questions like, well, where, what is this? You know, here's a small detail in the background. Is it actually more important than we think? You know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Whereas when I go out and it's, you know, like a normie interviewing me, it'll be like, where do you get your ideas? You know, that's a question. But so far I haven't had a detail oriented question, which is always a little bit of relief.
Gotcha. No, I'm one of those ones where it's torn, because I think a lot of interviewers are writing this from the perspective of like, okay, aspiring authors want to know. Right. As to where I interview authors much more from, I'm a reader and a fan. And, you know, and these are the questions I have, which is why it's so hard not to get into the spoiler questions, because I've read the book and there's questions I want to ask you, but I don't want somebody to see this and they're like, well, that just ruined it. You know, you took away all the mystery. You took all the suspense. So I got to kind of play that fine line. But yeah, I just like sitting down and chatting with an author and see where the conversation goes. So you're an author. You're a martial artist. Anybody who's ever read one of your books has known you're a martial artist for, I think that was at the back of Stormfront, you know, the fact that you're a martial artist.
I believe I have been careful to always say martial arts enthusiast. That's
Sorry. You were probably right. You wrote it. Yes, a martial arts enthusiast.
I want to convey my enthusiasm, not necessarily my skill.
Gotcha. Exactly. We're not taking on anybody in a fight necessarily. Got it.
Yeah. Well, I'm feisty enough for a non-professional, but I have no illusions about what would happen if I went up against somebody who was, you know, that was their business.
Yeah. No, I don't care how far down he is on the roster. I'm not taking on anybody who's fought in the UFC. That's all there is to it. I don't care how bad they were. But are there any skills, you know, people ask you about writing. I'm sure some people as an enthusiast ask you about martial arts. Is there any skills that you have that maybe aren't well known that, you know, it's like, why doesn't nobody ever ask me about this? Or I wish my fans knew this about me.
Well, let's see. I did. I worked as a professional wrangler when I was a teenager.
Oh, nice.
And I rode and performed in a rodeo performance group called Rodeo Kids, where we did precision drill riding, we did stunt riding. So I can do a number of tricks on horses, from, you know, standing on their back while they're running to doing cartwheels off the saddle at a full run. I did a lot of work with horses when I was growing up. So that was one of my big things was, you know, after reading fantasy, I noticed everybody rode horses. So I'm like, well, if I'm gonna do that, I need to know all about horses myself. Plus, I got into the Walter Farley books when I was a kid.
Nice. You know,
the Black Stallion books. So I've always loved riding. I still go whenever I can arrange it now. Let's see. I do archery. I do sword fighting. Largely, I do boffer combat and LARP. But I went through épée and saber in college. Yeah, that was back when every car had a practice saber on it as an antenna, and you could, you know, the guys would get wild, go out to the parking lot, pull the antennas off of cars, and beat each other with them. And you get your techniques down, your fundamentals down real quick when you get those purple stripes when you miss.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, I do leather working. I do a number of other crafts that are, you know, that I've used to make myself equipment and so on for my various hobbies. So I seem to be drawn to skills that are not terribly useful today.
They're useful for your writing, though. Yeah.
They are. They're useful for me. And, you know, I get to be part of a tradition that helps keep alive. So that's cool.
Exactly. I teased my sister-in-law. She heard my brother named her son D'Artagnan. I'm like, you know, he's going to have to learn how to fence, right? It's just a requirement.
Yeah. Yeah.
So kind of a wrap up then, I ask everybody, I'm live streaming on Twitch, so obviously I don't have a big issue with Amazon. However, comma, when it comes to books, mm-hmm. I do love my brick and mortars. The brick and mortars, if an author visits your town, Amazon didn't bring them, your local bookstore brought them. Shout out to favorite bookstore of yours, brick and mortar.
Oh, well, I mean, I just got done. There's several that have been really great to me over the years that I've gone to over and over on my tours.
Do you want to mention a couple? I'm going to put shout outs in the description.
Mysterious Galaxy in San Diego has always been really great for me. Poison Pen down
in Scottsdale. You love that one.
It's been great. Let me think. Tattered Cover here in Denver. And I'll be signing for them, I think, a week from today. And there's others that I'm not going to remember that they're blinking out of my head. I can see them in my head, but I can't see the name on their store.
As I tell people all the time, if the list gets too long, then somebody wants to know why they got left off. So, you know, two to three is probably about perfect. Otherwise, like I said, somebody's feelings are going to be hurt. And I think I haven't been to Mysterious Galaxy, but I know they've had a shout out before. Been to the Tattered Cover, been to Poison Pen.
University Bookstore in Seattle. I've done a bunch of signings for them up there.
That one I don't know.
And they, you know, they have had me in several times. So.
Gotcha. I went to the Cuth Buzzard while I was there. I did not go to the university. Oh, one last question. I did not add it. This one's probably going to be an easy one. This one you can answer off the top of your head. What are you reading right now?
Right now I'm reading James J. Butcher, my son. He has started his first series, and he started in urban fantasy because he said, I figure I'll be able to sell some copies on that one. I said, yeah, you But he writes a very different story than I do. He's learned about half of his craft from me and the other half from watching Brandon Sanderson's online courses on YouTube. And so he lands somewhere between me and Sanderson, which I feel is probably a pretty good spot for somebody to be as a young writer. So, but if you read his series, it's called Dead Hand, and the next one is Long Past Dues. And so, you know, that's a good series. I've also been reading Jen Blackstream's Blood Trail series. She writes an urban fantasy series that is very, very quick, tightly paced, very well put together mysteries. She really likes the mystery aspect of writing.
Gotcha. All right. As long as he doesn't make them as big as Way of Kings, I think I might have to check out James. Related question, if you know one off the top of your head, somebody who likes Cinder Spires, who else do you think they'd like?
If you like Cinder Spires, you would probably also like, I would check out the Mistborn series by Sanderson. And then his follow-up series to that one, the Wax and I forget the other guy's name book, but that's also a very strong steampunk sensibility series.
I think I've got a Lantern sitting on my nightstand waiting to be read, to be honest.
if you like the Cinder Spires, go check out David Weber's Honor Harrington series. That's also kind of an Age of Sail, but set in science fiction in space. That there's a lot of similarities and has definitely influenced me. And then back to kind of the source series, which is the Horatio Hornblower novels by C.S. Forrester. You would really, I really wondered if I would enjoy those because they came out in the very early 20th century. And I really wondered if I would enjoy, you know, the difference in vernacular and so on. But let me tell you, Forrester can write a good story. And I mean, he is solid. And I have really enjoyed his work as well.
All right. And I think you mentioned it, but I just want to draw attention to it for anybody who missed it. I swear it's going to be Dresden next. Is that the next one that was coming out? Is it the next Dresden novel?
Yeah, I've got to finish it. The next novel is called 12 Months. And it's about, you know, it's Harry really, he took a hit at the end of our last book. And, you know, the world is never going to be the same. And, you know, when there's big, you know, society shattering events like that that happen, it causes all kinds of things. And we've all lived through that the past 5 years or so. And, you know, so how do you deal with that? How do you change your expectations? How do you, you know, face up to great loss and great pain? And that's a lot of what the book is about. And then there's also ghouls and politics, and there's Black Court vampires and lots of frenemies, because I like those. And
they're fun to write.
Basically, the good, basically, you know, the stuff you like in every Dresden novel. But this story is set, instead of being a frantic pace over a few days, is set over the course of a year. So we get to see sort of what Dresden's year looks like as he's going through. And, you know, actually, I think it's kind of a quiet year in many ways, but it still should be fairly exciting as a read.
So just knowing how publishing works, I'm guessing late 24, early 25 before we see that.
It's going to depend on me getting it done in time, and it's going to depend on schedule and a bunch of stuff. Penguin's going to want to get it out as quick as they can, because they know readers are interested in it. And, you know, Penguin wants to make some money too.
Yes. And, you know, strike while the iron's hot and all that. And it's, you know, you get a good cliffhanger, you got to use it to your advantage. Okay. All right. So it's been almost 50 minutes. I'm just going to take this opportunity to thank Jim for coming out, taking time out of his day to come talk to us about this book. Like I said, it sounds weird to tell you to buy two books at once, but Warrior Born is, like I said, 146 pages. It's super short. If you've got a day to spend on it, you will finish it. It's not that long. And it definitely leads up to the Olympia Affair. And as much as I've loved all of Jim's books, I have to say, I personally think the Olympian Affair is the best one yet. It's my two cents.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Grab those two books. I will have links and everything to Jim's, everything you currently have. By the way, and we need to get you on Blue Sky. I'm just telling you that. Twitter's dying. But I have links to all of your socials for people if they want to connect. I'm going to have, obviously, some links to your books and stuff. They will be Amazon affiliate links, but I still tell everybody, use Amazon if you don't have any other options. Otherwise, go to your local bookstore. That's just my two cents. All right. Thanks again, Jim. Appreciate it. And have a good rest of your day.